with NERSA and ESCOM, the Department of Minerals and Energy. We will go through the program. I think everybody has got a mini agenda there of what is going to take place this morning. We've got here the apology that has been sent out is Mr. Schmidt of the DA is away on an overseas trip, understandably, and Mrs. Dreyer is here to represent the DA in his place. Welcome, Mr. Dreyer. Any other apologies? So far we don't have any other apologies tender. And I'm sure members will be having our program as revised. We have revised the program slightly in order to accommodate the question of MPRDA plus also the problem of created by the public hearings of these other bills that have not yet reached Parliament. We thought that therefore we should make some slight changes which we need this committee to adopt here. As you can see, on the 11th of June, we have also included a certain item, which is presentation by Conserve Energy Group. This is a group which is advocating that it has got a technology of saving energy, as they call themselves, a Conserve Energy Group. And so they want to present to us what they have as energy-saving technology. So we thought that it is important to fit them in our program, and on the 11th of June, we thought that this may be a brief briefing, so we could fit them in there. And then on the 18th, so we have now the briefing on the 18th of June on energy master plan. We've cancelled, they were supposed there to be public hearings on energy bill, and we thought that actually the 20th also, the committee secretary made a slight mistake. 20th of June is a Friday, and that's when these public hearings on energy bill will simply not be done. We had thought that we would do them on the 18th Wednesday and on the 20th, 2 days. But they can't take place because procedurally we have to advertise this, and we must give the public no less than 2 weeks. And as it is now, this energy bill and others are still with the state law advisors, and themselves they take something close to a month before they release it to Parliament. So it's clear that by the 18th, 20th, these bills will still not be at the level of being think the secretary. So we must delete 20 public hearing also. It must also be deleted. So therefore, we have replaced 18th of June by, we have actually put MPRDA, and then we've replaced it here and put the briefing on the energy security master plan by DME on the 18th. And on the 20th, then there will be no public hearing, so that's not there's no sitting on that on this day. I think you must just take note of that. So far those are the changes that we have made, which we appealed to the committee to adopt. Adoption and seconda.
To adoption of the changes.
Seconda.
Nongula Mativela, seconda.
Thank you. The program as amended has been adopted. We will see, honourable members, when these bills come before Parliament, then we'll see again where we can fit them in, and we will have again to re-adopt that particular amended program. Thank you very much. Otherwise, honourable Dreyer.
Just a question for information. I just see interesting on the proposed or the draft program. We've got various meetings throughout July, August, September, up to October. Then on the 17th October, it's the last meeting on this year, during this year. Then it's only going on next year. What happens after the 17th of October? Won't there be any further sittings? Won't Parliament be active?
Can I repeat that? Sorry, what did you say?
The last meeting of this committee is on the 17th of October, and nothing further for the rest of this year. What happens in the latter part of this year? Because the next meeting after the 17th of October is only scheduled on the 21st of January for next year. So what happens after the 17th of October? Won't Parliament be active?
No, actually, these are just, as you see, we keep on adopting. These are just draft programs. We want to fit in public hearings in those weeks, because there are many, if you remember, there are many legislations that are before this committee. So we are reserving some of those days if we can fit in only we deal with public hearings.
Or are we going to fight an election then?
No. If we fight an election, we will tell you, won't hide, because we'll be public about election. But for now, let us not put things up in the cart before the horse. We hope that the election will come when it will come, and we'll be ready for it. But for now, according to our program, this program is for the committee, and we will be looking into public hearings rather than anything else. Yeah, thank you very much, Honourable Dre. Right, I'll leave I think it would be better if we start with ESCOM to brief us on this electricity emergency and pricing. Thank you. Before I start, I must familiarize you with the members here. I'm sure there are some probably new faces, so that you must know who you are dealing with. Starting with this desk, I'm Ngabangi Robo, the chairperson of the committee from the African National Congress. Peter Paul, the committee's new committee secretary. I'll introduce all the new people. Honorable Nareng, there is our new committee whip. And then I'll give the rest to introduce themselves. I'll start here.
I'm Mokoti Siadimo, member of this committee.
I'm Nomvula Mativela, member of Minerals and Energy.
Danny Kikana, member of Minerals and Energy. Charlie
Charlie ANC, member of this committee.
James Mokwena, Professor Chair for the committee.
Anshin Dreyer, member of this committee.
Okabanu Mashaba, Elungala this committee.
I want to know, there are too many people. I want to know if there are people of the media here.
Mike Cohen from Bloomberg News. Bloomberg News.
Linda Ince for Business Day. Linda Ince for Business Day. BMG.
Oh, that's my secretary, Lizelle. Lizelle Webb, also secretary. Chintal. There at the end. Right, I'll allow therefore ESCOM and NERSA to also introduce their delegations. I think there is also DME. All of you introduce yourselves.
On my left, Mr. Chairman, is Joe Johnson, is the advisor to ESCOM. Myself, Jacob Maroga, ESCOM, and Justice Mavungo, ESCOM.
Smanda Mukwena Nersa. Tembani Kukula Nersa.
Ambassador Kutu from Nersa.
Charles Severa Nersa.
I'm Futi Tegalala DME.
Lindu Mekwe DME.
Sibundi Machini DME.
I'm Stefina Mudau from the Department of Minerals and Energy.
There are two gentlemen there who have not described themselves. They are underground, are they?
Andre Yodan from SABC Radio.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Excellencies. Right, we can start our research and start our business. Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, before we start, maybe we just need to have an indication of timing.
All right. We've got here up to 1 o'clock. So we have got three presentations. So we can divide this time according to, let's see. I think we must dedicate more time to ESCOM because, I think to NERSA. NERSA are the people who are judges who will. Yeah, I think we must get more time to NERSA. ESCOM, we will give you 20 minutes of presentation. And we will give more time for interaction with NERSA, I think, because that's where the key lies. And then we will give 40 minutes to NERSA. So then we have 1 hour, is that so? So it means from now, half past 10 to half past 11, I think we must have up to 12. From now up to 12, NERSA and ESCOM. So let's see. We give ESCOM 40 minutes, right? give NERSA one hour. So, let me see, let me calculate. It's 40, 60. How many minutes do we have here? It's about 2.5 hours, which is 120. Plus 30 is 150 minutes. Yeah. I think we'll have 1 hour with NERSA, 40 with ESCOM. And then the rest will be for MPRTA. Yeah, let's work it out like that. Thank you.
Chairman, I assume the 40 includes questions.
Yeah.
So I have to optimize that 40.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, a presentation has been prepared and has been circulated. First of all, I need to thank you for giving us the opportunity to come here and have a conversation with the committee. What I'll do, Mr. Chairman, maybe let me just give you the short version of what I'm going to say. What are the key messages? Mr. Chairman, the first key message is that the power system in South Africa has run out of reserve capacity. The problem or the challenge in South Africa today is because we've run out of reserve capacity. And I think that's a very key and important point to understand, because everything else stems from a constraint and shortage of reserve margin. And I'll indicate why reserve margin is critical to a power system. The second message, Mr. Chairman, is that the power emergency is deep, is material, and is very, very serious. It is not an emergency that is going to go away in a number of months. It is not an emergency that can be wished away in a very short space of time. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort to resolve. That's the second key message that I need to leave with the committee. And the third message is related to the second message is, we run a power system which is very, very vulnerable. A system that is likely to have a number of interruptions impacting on society for a number of years. The fourth message, Mr. Chairman, is that the solutions are a combination of increasing of supply, that is building more power stations, and I'll give you some details in terms of what we're doing. But the other part of the solution is the reduction of consumption and the reduction of demand. So in short, the fourth message, Mr. Chairman, is the solution lies with all of us, all of South Africa, and all of society. The solutions do not lie only with ESCOM. The fifth message, Mr. Chairman, is we are in a very serious funding challenge. I'll show the numbers, but over the next, up to 2025, we're going to be spending in excess of 1.3 trillion rand to bring additional capacity into South Africa. That capacity is going to be required to be funded adequately. And the last message, Mr. Chairman, is whichever way you look at it, prices of electricity in South Africa will have to go up significantly to ensure that we've got a power system that is both secure and financially sustainable. So if there's anything that you missed in the presentation, those are the six key messages that I want to leave with you. I'm not going to be going through all of the slides given the time constraints, but I will take them that you've read and the presentation is with yourself. So I'll try to optimize on the question time, because that's where I would want to be able to answer any clarification that the committee has.
I think I'll give you extra 20 minutes because I do not want us to sweep through. This is very important. I'll give you more 20 minutes then. So give us, there must be no slide with which you think is important that you shouldn't go through.
Great, Mr. Chairman, I'll do so. The contents, as you see, Mr. Chairman, will talk about the challenge at hand and measures adopted to meet them. We'll give some update on the progress we have made. Then we'll go into the key principle underlying our pricing application, the regulatory rules and their impact on ESCOM. We'll review the recent history. We'll go into winter of 2007. We'll touch on the ESCOM recovery program, and we'll review the load shedding and energy savings to date, and we'll leave you with the prognosis for the winter that is coming. The challenges at hand, one, the financial sustainability of ESCOM, I've indicated that for 2008-2009, we face a very daunting financial challenge. We have seen significant increases in the price of primary fuel, which is coal and diesel that we use for our power stations. We are seeing a capital expansion program that is growing and also putting pressure on the cost to ESCOM, though the capital expansion is not the primary driver in the current application, but in the underlying requirement for funding long term, it's a key driver. As you know, we had applied for 18% and we're given 14.2%, but our analysis of the financial numbers is that if we accept that as the final number, we will incur significant losses. You may have seen in the media, Mr. Chairman, significant rating agencies have expressed a concern about the long-term financial sustainability of ESCOM. Both Standard & Poor's and Moody's have issued statements with respect to the credit rating of ESCOM. In fact, both those rating agencies are awaiting the outcome of the current pricing and funding discussion for them to make a call about the credit rating of ESCOM. And if indeed it goes negative, the implications are that not only our sources of funding will be constrained, if we get the funding, it will come at considerable cost to us and putting pressure on the prices of electricity and pressure on the financial sustainability of the power system. Indeed, these are extraordinary times, Mr. Chairman. As I've indicated, we have run out of reserve margin, and it's well known. We have run out of reserve margin primarily because the decisions to start construction of power system, of the power stations to improve the reserve margin, came only in 2004. It should have come much, much earlier. And I think the history has been discussed and documented, but the reality is we run a system with a very constrained reserve margin. We've got aging plant, that is, some of them are 40, 30 years old, which are run harder, and some of them run beyond their design capacity. The window of opportunity for doing maintenance is becoming tighter and tighter because of constrained reserve margin. Operating costs are increasing at a more rapid pace, particularly the cost of primary energy, which is coal and diesel. And I'll talk to, maybe this is the time to talk to that particular point. The reason you require sufficient reserve margin in the power system is for a number of reasons, but two key reasons. You require enough space in your power system such that, for whatever reason, if you have a problem, one power station goes down, you don't impact on customers. You need that space. If you don't have that space, what actually happens is that one or two problems impact on customers. So reserve margin is a concept used worldwide in the power system to ensure that you have enough to take care of short-term problems. They happen everywhere in the world. The second problem related to reserve margin is that when you run a power system, you've got power stations that have different costs to run. Normally our big power stations, we call them base load, are the cheapest to run. Then you've got smaller ones called the peaking stations, which are the most expensive to run. When you have reserve margin, the flexibility at which you run your system is that most of the time you run the cheapest stations, and a few times you run the peaking station because you've got enough room. Peaking stations are most expensive, so they're not designed from a cost point of view to run most of the time. When you run out of reserve capacity, you've got no flexibility. You run everything you got. And the consequences of that, you run your most expensive station much harder than you had planned, and the cost becomes a big implication. Let me just give you an example. A typical base load coal station compared to a peaking diesel fired station. When you run the diesel fired station, it is 30 times more expensive compared to your base load station. We procured and built peaking station run on diesel with an intention to run them only 6% of the time. Since November, we've been running in some of them up to 50% of the time. That has significant cost implications because you're running them on diesel. So just to summarize this point, because it's a very important point to understand, is that you require reserve margin to have security of supply. You require reserve margin to be able to optimize on your cost. Once you run out of reserve margin, all those key aspects are compromised. The other element, as I've indicated, we have applied for significant price increases driven by primary energy. But we've got a very massive capital investment. Over the next 5 years, 343 billion, which we need to spend. And up to 2025, we estimate 1.3 trillion that we have to spend to bring online the power stations that we need. Load shedding remains a possibility, and I want to indicate here, load shedding can happen anytime. When you have a reserve margin as tight as we have, it takes one or two units. You move from a stable grid to a grid that requires load shedding. So we have stopped scheduled load shedding, but emergency load shedding is a possibility and it can happen anytime. It's our intention to be able to anticipate, to be able to communicate before we do load shedding, but I need to warn South Africa that it can happen anytime. As we have seen, 24th of January was a very black day for South Africa when we had to declare a national emergency, and it had an impact on the industrial output of South Africa, and after that we had to request 10% reduction. It was a very significant and extraordinary measure we had to take to stabilize the grid. Also, let me say, should we have not taken the precaution, and should the worst have happened, what could
could have been the implication? No one really knows because we've not been there before. But the implication of a total blackout in South Africa, the consequences could take a long time to repair. Our system operations tells us that they estimate that it could take 2 weeks to bring the system back to full operation after a full blackout. What it means, 2 weeks of total darkness in South Africa. So it's something that we continuously monitor and make sure we never get to. So the 24th of January was one measure to prevent such an eventuality, and we need to make that point. And as you know, we have seen also some significant steps from our shareholder, the government, where 60 billion has been announced as support for Eskom, and we're discussing with the shareholder in terms of how that is going to be dispersed. Where are we now from January? I think a number of things have happened, and we have also been assisted by our key industrial customers, particularly where they've reduced their demand. And we've been able to complete some significant plant maintenance, which frees up capacity for the winter months. We have worked hard to limit further unplanned outages. We've got a target to limit it to 2,500 megawatts. And there's a trend downwards of unplanned outages. We had to rebuild our coal stocks. Our target is 20 days going into winter. We are about 18 days. There is some progress, but there is still some significant challenges in repairing the stocks to 20 days. And we'll be showing with you, that since 2004, there is some significant capacity that we brought online. It was the refurbishment of the old power stations that have been mothballed, and also new peaking stations that are running and operating in the Western Cape. Looking at the financial constraints, clearly we're going to need a combination of measures to deal with the financial constraints. It's going to be a combination of shareholder support, significant price increases, and internal efficiencies, particularly dealing with operations and procurement, that will be required to deal with the financial challenges that we're having. As I've indicated, maintaining a good credit rating is going to be key for Eskom to access funds and pay for those funds in the most affordable way. As I've indicated, Mr. Chairman, we have embarked on a very, very ambitious capital expansion program, and it's my own assessment that you'd, outside of China and India, you are unlikely to see one company executing such a big capital expansion program. Already we have committed 18,000 megawatts that we will construct. Our board, since 2004, since the government gave the go-ahead for Eskom to build power stations, we have committed 264 billion in projects that have been approved. In terms of contracts that have been placed, we have already placed 83 billion worth of contracts, and those are the power stations that are listed for each of those that we have made commitments to. Since 2004, since the decision was made for Eskom to start building power station, we have spent 54.6 billion in improving and bringing new capacity to the power system. In this financial year, we focused that we will spend 46 billion. Maybe this is where we need to reflect, Mr. Chairman. 46 billion per annum equates to 23 million per working hour. So in an hour that you've given me, Eskom would have spent 23 million in bringing capacity to South South Africa. And this number is going to be increasing. As I've indicated to you, Mr. Chairman, since 2004, we have brought online 2,600 megawatts that is running and operating and contributing to the power system. 1,000 kilometers of overhead lines, 4,700 of transformer capacity, 6 new substations, and we're seeing 1,000 megawatts of demand-side management reduction in the power system since 2004. In dealing with the key principle underlying our application, the first one, prices need to reflect the efficient cost of electricity. I don't think it's a difficult concept to grasp. In a system where you are not bringing new capacity, you can get away with it for some time. You have excess capacity, you've got power stations that are fully paid, so what you're looking for is only operating cost. However, when you begin to bring new capacity on stream, the cost of the new capacity versus the current average price is a big disconnect. So we need to start reflecting that cost in our price. But we need to also recognize that our tariff structure must also take into account the issue of affordability. As Eskom, we have, since 1994, we have electrified close to 4 million new customers. It is important that the new customers also continue to benefit from electricity. Hence, the price should also, the price regime should be such that it doesn't have a negative impact on the poor. So we need to recognize that. The tariff regime also needs to recognize the volatility of some of the aspects of the cost in our cost mix, in particular, the fuel cost and the capital cost. Let me talk about the capital cost, Mr. Chairman, just give you an example. We have not been building power stations for 20 years. The stations that we have refurbished were the ones we have built and we're just bringing back again on service, so you cannot learn much from them in terms of new power stations. The new big power station that we're building is in Lephalale, they called Medupi. When we initially issued the tender, we spent some time and we brought in international expertise to assist us in forecasting what the final cost of that power station could be, because we didn't have enough expertise. So when overseas got consultants, please give us some indication of what this power station is going to cost us, so that as we take it through our investment processes, we can have a clue, well, an idea of how much it's going to cost. Even with that homework that we did, when we opened the tenders, two surprises, Mr. Chairman. The first surprise was that the amount of interest on our power station was limited to only two. We had expected at least 10 companies to tender for that power station. The second surprise was that the price was 30% higher than what we had forecasted. And as we get into this program, that's the kind of surprises we're beginning to see. Prices of capital goods related to power generation are going up at a fast rate, driven by what is happening in China, what is happening in India, and what is beginning to happen worldwide in terms of the power sector. So what we say is, as we design our tariff mechanism, we need to design them to be able to cater for this volatility in the price of capital goods. And on the fuel side, which is primarily coal and diesel, we are also saying the same. One of the issues that I need to indicate, average price of our power station in terms of coal, 100 rand per ton. Average. Export quality coal, 100 we begin to purchase on the spot market, the spot price of coal is beginning to follow the export price of coal. One is 100 rand, the other is $100. That's the challenge we're beginning to see. Okay? The next slide, the seven, I think I've described it in the previous one, but I think it's a recognition that a robust regulatory mechanism should be able to cater for the volatility of the cost drivers that we see. Let me just give you an example where a similar pricing mechanism has been applied. As you know, Mr. Chairman, today the price of oil is probably $130 per barrel. A few years ago, I think in the mid-90s, probably $20 per barrel. There's a direct correlation between the price of oil and the price of petrol. There is a formula that takes the price of oil and converts it into the price of petrol. That is some kind of a pass-through and a recognition that to make petrol, you're going to have to be exposed to the price of oil. To make electricity, you are exposed to the price of coal. And if that price goes up, there must be a mechanism that begins to reflect the price of electricity following the price of coal. But there must also be a mechanism that examines the prudency of that pass-through. But the principle of a commodity or a product whose price is related to another commodity, I think is well known. Petrol is one of them. So that's the kind of mechanism we're looking for. How it works, obviously, in electricity may have to work differently. But what we say, it is not sustainable for Eskom to be exposed to the risk of coal prices without a mechanism to deal with that. It's not sustainable. So that's the issue that we have to deal with. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think I've also dealt with the issue of the requirement of the reserve margin is in the presentation for completeness and for the record. You require a sufficient reserve margin for a power system like ourselves so that you can deal with short-term challenges and have the flexibility to optimize your cost. And that's the point I needed to make, and the point I also made was that we are focused in making sure our focus, one of the focus is making sure that we never go to the blackout stage in South Africa, because we go to an untested, uncharted territory which may have serious long-term consequences for South Africa. And the next slide also show the two components of reserve margin. The one is operating reserve margin, which is more short-term. The other is net reserve margin, which is more long-term. Both deals with the ability and the flexibility of running a system to deal with security of supply and also deal with the flexibility of running your most optimum stations first. In terms of recovery for Eskom, Mr. Chairman, firstly is the supply side initiative, making sure that our power station can run reliably. We have enough of off. So it's a combination of maintaining what we have and dealing with urgent maintenance, but also focusing on the build program. The demand side, the recent initiative is to talk to municipalities, the top 11 municipalities. In fact, the top 11 municipalities in terms of consumption, probably outside of Eskom, they probably represent about 80% of consumption. We're focusing on them, we're working with them to begin to hardwire demand side management and make it a permanent feature in the system. The third element is planning an expansion, ensuring that the integration right across the system in terms of planning is much, much more slicker than we have seen so that we as we navigate this very tight system, we can anticipate challenges and we can respond to them in a more organized fashion. And as I've indicated, from ESCOM side, we've got our own program of expansion which we're dealing with them. Let us also deal with, in terms of the supply side, other than the ESCOM program, there is a definite opportunity to get, though small, but to get some delivery capacity from large industrial customers in South Africa. That opportunity is called coal generation. Is based on the fact that there is a possibility that some industrial processes do have excess heat, either in the form of steam or flare gas, that can be converted into electricity. The challenge in the past has been for these industrial customers to invest in converting this heat into electricity. They needed to have clarity about tariffs and clarity about contracting medium to long term for them to make this investment a viable investment. So we've been working with the regulator to have a mechanism that can unlock this opportunity, and we believe that it's one supply side intervention that can come much quicker. Maybe in the next 18 months we may start seeing output from coal generation plants, but we also are looking for private participants in the sector. And I need to clarify that from an ESCOM perspective, we encourage, we want to see private participation in the power sector. And the reasons are very clear and simple. Given the size of the expansion that we're going to be undertaking, we take a view that we cannot claim to know it all, and we cannot claim that we'll be able to do it all. We believe with the right regulatory framework, right tariff structure, we are able to attract private players, and they will be able to bring their balance sheets to bear to invest in South Africa, but they can also bring in required skills, which is an issue in South Africa, and maybe unlock new areas of supply for capital goods. So we will actively encourage the participation of private players in the South African power system. I'm not going to go into the color coding. It's in the presentation. It will be clear. But I just need to talk to you about last year's winter and how we performed. We have a 18-month rolling plan where we look at forecasting demand for the next 18 months and looking at the supply side option to supply that demand. And on that basis, we color code the risk. Where you see red, we worry. Where you see yellow, it's okay. And orange is in between red and yellow. Here you don't see brown or green. Green is we find. Brown is likely to have load shedding. This is the picture of last year winter. The left side color coding is what was predicted. The right hand side color coding is the actual. You could see more yellows than we anticipated, but towards the end of July, more red. But let me say, in last year winter, we went through the winter fairly okay because we didn't have to do any load shedding, it was tight. And the reason for going through winter last year without load shedding, two issues. One, better than anticipated generation performance. Two, in May last year we brought on stream the new power stations, the open cycle gas turbine and the peaking stations, which we used them extensively during winter, and they assisted us in going through the winter. But also we used extensively arrangements with key industrial customers where on a short-term basis you can switch them off or take off some capacity from them. And interruptible contracts, particularly with smelters, where we have contracts to reduce their output. output of their demand if we require. So the combination of good performance on generation and demand side intervention with Kinder for customers assisted us in going through 2007 winter without load shedding. Okay? And those are the statistics in terms of the peak compared to 2006. 4% of a 5% increase in even in peak compared to 2006, and for morning peak about 6%, but energy consumption daily also about 6%. This slide does indicate the kind of challenges we have when we deal with the winter. And the fact that as much as we come with an average hourly figure, in that hour, the demand could be much higher than the hourly average, and you have to have the reserve to deal with that. And we experienced our increase in demand from about 5:30 p.m. in the evening, but we've got systems to monitor and make sure that we can go through those peaks without threatening the system. While the issues on the generation side, we also look at transmission networks because they also get heavily loaded. Okay. And I've already indicated what we did in terms of 2007 winter. The growth compared to 2006, 1,700 megawatts, good performance of generation, strong relations with customers to reduce demand. We had the open cycle gas turbine, which came in time, and of course, extensive planning to make sure that we don't have mismatches, preparing the coal stocks for winter, and making sure that we've got enough liquid fuels for the OCGTs, and also making sure that when the demand materializes, we've got the vigilance to deal with whatever comes our way. There was a question about why we stopped scheduled load shedding. We started scheduled load shedding on the basis of a saving that was required to recover and deal with some urgent maintenance. Scheduled load shedding is not a preferred option. Our systems are not designed for load shedding. When we do load shedding, it stresses both the human resource systems, the customer relations systems, and the ability to deal with the networks gets stressed. So it's not a preferred option. It's not something that you want to do over a long period of time. But if the system is under stress, we do it in emergency, and we did it for a scheduled period because we're not seeing the savings coming through. But when we started having conversation with municipalities in terms of the programs that they were doing, we started having a clearer sense that if we can accelerate and focus on those programs, we can get savings without doing load shedding, hence the kind of discussion we are having with municipalities. Okay. In terms of evidence of savings overall, we have seen for demand across the system, we've seen up to 5%, for energy across the system, we've seen 5%. For demand, we've seen up to 7%. The biggest contributors has been Kinder for customers, and overall averaging about 8% from Kinder for customers. As I've indicated, we're focusing attention on the top 11 metros, and there are a number of things that they're doing which we are coordinating, and we want that to be the big focus as opposed to scheduled load shedding. And there's a task team that I lead that deals with the top 11 metros. We also have a task team with Kinder for customers, which we started after January, where the Kinder for customers are able to provide input in terms of the number of activities that ESCOM is undertaking so that we have a collaborative and collective effort to manage the system, ideas about saving, and also emergency protocols. Should we go to a point where we went in January the 24th, so that they can do the necessary emergency measures to make their processes safe. Mr. Chairman, as I'm rushing through to make sure that I have enough time for questions, I need to deal with and conclude with the prognosis for this winter. We have scenarios that we've modeled. The scenarios from the most pessimistic to the most optimistic. The variables are what do we have on the supply side and what is the prognosis on the demand side. And the combination of those variables are the ones that will either conspire to have a successful winter or conspire to have a very, very difficult winter. Okay, we can go to the next one. This slide is a key slide for our national control. This indicates the measures that we have at the national control, the emergency measures to stabilize the system in real time when we have problems. The first one, called EL1, is the one that we do internally. In fact, we call it emergency level 1. That's when we run our power station for short durations higher than the maximum rating of our power stations. So we up the output of our power station. It's not something that we want to do more often because it stresses the power system. The next, called DMP, demand market participation, is where we contract with customers to reduce their demand at short notice. So we contract with them up front, we'll buy the demand back when we need it, and we pay them for its use. ILS is interruptible load shedding, but this is contracted load interruptions, and the biggest contributor here are the aluminum smelters, where if we've got problems, we ask them to reduce. Then we use our open cycle gas turbine, the most expensive plants to run. Then the last resort, if everything fails, then we go to emergency load shedding. That's just to indicate the continuum of the measures that we have and under what circumstances will we use them. If the system is green, there's very little usage of those emergency measures, but if it's brown, we could see there's extensive usage of those emergency measures. So the prognosis for winter, Mr. Chairman, is that if scenario A, which is you have no savings on the demand side, and what we see as the supply remains the same, and the various columns, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, indicate the level of unplanned outages that you allow. The higher the number, the better it is. So scenario A is the worst scenario, and the last column of 4,000, below 4,000 is the worst possible scenario. And as you see, it's brown, so it's going to be mostly load shedding if that happens. The middle scenario is some saving, and we begin to see some yellow and orange, which means it's not as tight, and the best scenario is C. If everybody saves and our power stations perform very well, there's a very good chance that load shedding will not happen in winter. So there's a contribution by ESCOM in terms of limiting unplanned outages, but there's a big contribution to society, from society, in terms of reducing demand. And Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need to overemphasize the point that winter 2008 is going to be the most difficult from a power system point of view. We can't, underemphasize that point. You can't hide it. It's what it is. And the way we go through the winter is going to be a demonstration of how well we work together to get out of this very difficult period. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, without going through all of the slides, energy saving is going to be a key not only for this winter, but for the next few years. On our side, it's not only generation plan that we need to look at, but also look at the transmission and distribution network to make sure that that does not cause problems as well. The issue of coal is being dealt with very, very seriously, and we're seeing some improvement. But we need to say that the system remains very, very vulnerable. In terms of prices, as we have indicated, tariffs must go up, but they must recognize the affordability to the poor. The pricing mechanism must recognize the volatility of fuel and capital goods. Pricing alone will not solve the problem. We believe the shareholder needs to come to the party. And for Eskom's financial sustainability to be maintained, we need a combination of all of those. Otherwise, the credit rating of Eskom will be in jeopardy. And the last slide, Mr. Chairman, deals with the regulatory issues. And the summary of it is the flexibility and the realization that we need to cater for the volatility of the items we've talked about is key. If we do not deal with that, and we've made this point to NERSA, if we do not deal with that, it may mean that every year we'll continue to go back to NERSA and say, these are the costs that we're incurring, and we believe Eskom cannot carry that burden. It has to be carried by the rest of society. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stop there. I hope I've been able to keep within your time and also allow the members to pose some questions. Thank you very much.
Well, not exactly, but it doesn't matter. What is important is the output and outcomes. I'll allow members to interact with you in this short time. Let me see now, I have, I'll allow 15 minutes of interaction. I have here Honorable Nareng, Honorable Kekane 2, Honorable Matibela 3, Honorable Bundesa 4, Mashaba 5, 6, Siatim, in that order. You will record. You'll record the questions for your responses, I guess.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. My name is Obam Nare. I just want to address a point. I thought in your country statement, Mr. CEO or MD, that you will deal with the percentages on your application. I know that you were granted 14.2%, and now it's not clear in your application that you still stick to 53% in terms of your price hikes. And if that is the case, I'm sure that as you were giving all sorts and forms of explanation, you could justify one thing or the other, but we need to understand that over a period of 5 years, are you insisting that you need a 53% hike based on motivating aspects of why you think you need that increment. Then when you give that explanation, then you explain that already 14%, 14.2 is alluded, is granted. Then at the same time, in terms of your megawatts, you also wanted 2% increment. In terms of your price structure, what does that 2% mean in terms terms of rents and cents. So as we have an idea or a clue on what would the projection be in 5 years down the line, then there is a point I want to raise around your ratings. I just want to check what impacts or affects your ratings. If your ratings have to be positive, what are the issues which make them positive? And if they are negative, what are the aspects? We are mindful of the fact that the Eskom has been an entity which over the years has not been running on a loss. It is a very good and big profit generating company. So if those explanations are given, then we'll be in a position to understand why do we have a crisis, and why can't Eskom revert back to their profit margins if they have to increase their capacity on generating electricity. So that is a point I just wanted to check on. But at the end of the day, I'm sure that the issues around sensitivity to the poor are actually going to be considered. If consideration is made around that explanation should be given in this forum, such that we're in a position to understand. Because we know that we are not going to target hiking in the same way as targeting, you know, there is agriculture, there is manufacturing, there is business, and there are ordinary communities. So maybe that variation has to be placed as a matter of principle, such that we understand it in this committee. Thank you. Maybe some of the issues I want to bring on board, I'll make follow-ups later.
Ekane? Yeah, thanks. We just want to pep you up, because we see for the first time you've mentioned that you're considering affordability and the poor in your configuration there in the tariff. So that is actually a very good thing. We'll see the final result. My question is still linked on the poor. And the question is based on the fact that in this total scheme of things, remember when our economic policy was reviewed and as GISA and GIPSA came about, we're told that the economy has grown well. Maybe that is why we're running short of electricity, because it has grown. And that if the economy, because the big problem was it is growing, but it is not creating jobs. And we're questioning, what's the fun of having an economy that grows, which can benefit its own people by means of creating jobs? And we're told it has grown four and a half or up to 5%, and for it to start creating the needed jobs in the country, it will have to grow beyond 6%. Now, the big question is, now while we're looking forward, that will push the economy to grow beyond 6% so that we can start creating the needed jobs. There it is now that we're running short of electricity, and it is key because business or industry is the one that consumes more electricity than ordinary residents. Now, the big question is that we worry that we should save electricity. And while we worry that we should save electricity, we're looking forward that in fact we're going to spend more electricity on growing the economy. And that was going to benefit the nation. Now, you want us to say we're looking forward to spending more of it and growing the economy to create the needed jobs. So what's going to happen about jobs and the poor? Do you think they should wait for 5 years until the capacity is there? The 5 years that you're going to spend 327 billion, or even 2025 when you'll be spending a trillion. I mean, you're talking about hungry stomachs.
Yeah, Mathieu.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. My first question is on the 11 top metros. I just wanted to know, because I thought, I don't know if we have now increased metros from 6 to 11. That's just what I wanted to know. And the other thing, again, is that with this prices, is it, are we pricing also to have our, to have your performance bonuses to secure that or what? The other one is again on the capacity of when you presented, you were saying that you got tenders, and because people were not well, they don't know, they are not well trained. I just wanted to know, what was Eskom doing for all the years that it was there, that we have still got to look out of the country for people to be able to construct power plants? The other thing also, yes, the aging plants, which are there. In 1994, when the government took over, the government was saying that in 5 years' time, they were going to, the government was going to electrify 1 million houses. At that time, Eskom could not think of adding something to do to in order for them to be able to keep the power going. And also, with the rating of the dollar, coal, and the 100 rand, how does it affect Eskom? Because the coal is not coming from America, where they're using a dollar, and here in South Africa using a rand. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on progress to date. In your report, you are saying that there is six new substations, but according to the chairperson, the chairperson of the Minerals and Energy last week, in his, not the chairperson of me, not you, chairperson. I'm saying not you. I'm saying not you, the director of Minerals and Energy. He says that there are 10 substations that have to be built. And from the 8 substations, there are only 8, from 10, there are only 8 that have been built, and 2 are still in progress. Now this is it's contradicting what has been said here. My other question is about, here we say we have 254 billion of project approved since 2004. And 83 is the contract placed in since 2004, and then 54 billion. I just want to know, does this is the plan for 5 years, and there is some money that is outstanding here. What is that money going to do with? Thank you.
Honorable Ndisa. After that, so let me just do this. After you Honorable Ndisa, it will be Honorable Ndisa, after Honorable Mashaba, after Mashaba, in that order.
Thank you, sir. Chair, although I'm partly covered, but there are these questions directly to ESCOM. Chair, we know that ESCOM is a profit-making organization. It's clear. But what I would like to know, what is the role of ESCOM to support in relation to ASCISA? Because nothing that appeared, which is appearing there in their slides, in terms of supporting ASCISA in terms of renewable energy. It means they don't want to support that because they are just looking at themselves that, no, we want to make money. But how to support the ASCISA? And why it doesn't appear, your program, in terms of supporting this ASCISA? Chair, the second question, and what impact the price hike will have on economic development? And the third one, Chair, what the impact will have on the working class, workers and the poor? The last one, Chair, before I talk about that one, always when ESCOM they are talking, or other companies, they just talk about China, Germany. We are not in Germany, we are not in China, we are in South Africa. In terms of unemployment, the rate of unemployment in South Africa is very high. You cannot compare South Africa with the well-developed countries like China and Germany. That one always, it should be taken away when you are addressing us, because we are living in a country of which the rate of unemployment is very high. The last one, general prices, inflation, food prices, etc. If you can look at it, etc. And why the burden on households, not much on business? I'm referring to ESCOM, Chairperson, and business and capitalists. You see, I think until so far, Chair, those are the questions, but I'll come later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Mr. Marojo for a very comprehensive presentation. I enjoyed it. But it's very clear from your presentation that the challenges we're facing are daunting. And it demands a very intricate set of solutions. Now, the problem is, while in South, like the rest of South Africa, we're facing a major skills crisis, you and ESCOM are no different there. You face the same skills crisis. Where will we find the people to help you address the problems that you obviously have to rectify?
Thanks, Chairperson. The
question that I want to ask is, if Eskom were to be given the 53% hike this year as they were requesting for 2008 and 2009, is it possible that the CEO can give us an indication as to how much would they be collecting by the end of the financial year? If you get the 53% in rand and cents, how much would that be? And indicate how much would you be able to use for this financial year. If you collect 53% more, how much would it be? And how much are you planning to spend on the expansion program? Would you be able, in other words, would you be able to spend the 53% if granted over 1 year? Taking into account the time that would take to build just the one station and procurement process and so on. The second one is that this is an indictment of poor planning. That in the past 5 years, we are caught up with this situation. Sometimes you'll find that people come and go, and ourselves as customers and the custodians of this democracy will always be expected to carry the blame. I think a lot of these things, if you talk about the issue of aging equipment, I don't think it's just aging now. It was known from the time when it was established and built that it will last for so many years. Yes, it can be overused, but the consequences should be put in part in planning. Now, I'm worried by the fact that some of those people who are there, who are costing us today, some of them turn around and become consultants and start back into Eskom. And what advice are they going to give you if they failed themselves? The other one is that it is very difficult for us not to understand how much electricity is sold to our neighboring countries and at what rate. And it goes back to some of the bigger customers of yours who we are hearing some of them are paying too less. And I'm looking into this arguing for a debate on the pricing regime. There is a need for us to look very closely on the tariff that Eskom is charging the different customers. It needs to be debated so that we can find as to what we could be able to advise. And the last part one is, to me, I think there might be a possibility, because we don't hear Eskom saying shareholders put more money. It's more about the customers. The very same customers who've been paying over the years, if you can look into the profits that have been made by Eskom from 1994, I'm talking about outside your, if you get a budget, operating budget and capital, and thereafter you look at what you receive as revenue, income and expenditure, you'll find each year you've been making profit. If you can look into the profit from 1994 to date, and look as to what you are looking for now, you'd find that the profit that you've made over the past 10 years could have been able to be available now to rescue you instead of us as the customers. If this was a private company, would a private company come to a customer and say, I've been selling to you and eating the profit, now you come, I want to build another supermarket there and I'm going to increase the price of food? No. We're just failing to understand how this could happen. Thanks, Chair.
I think Honorable Mashaba has partly covered me, but you know, no, I want them to ask him to speak more, to unpack it, because, you know, recently I think Minister Erwin, when he was talking about the electricity that is given to our neighboring countries. He called it economic xenophobia. When, as South Africans, we are faced with the challenge whereby we are told about load shedding and all these other challenges, can you speak more to that issue? He talked about the quantity that is given and to our neighboring countries. But I want you to unpack it a bit to say, how do you, because I did not understand what, exactly understand what he was saying when he said it's xenophobic, economic xenophobia. Because, you know, I'm raising this issue because at the same time, from the energy summit, Eskom is still insisting on the 53, the price hike that they talked about even before the summit. As if we have new challenges and new leadership at Eskom. In 1994, actually when the permission was given for the expansion, for the building of the new power plants, power stations, it's as if Eskom did not foresee, the leadership that we have at Eskom did not foresee the need to raise the prices of something of that nature. It's like when they wake up one day, they want to say to South Africans, now we want to hike the price to 153%. It's like there was no vision. They have not foreseen this kind of a challenge. It's only now when they wake up at some point that they are saying that. Are we? Because it brings into question the type of leadership that you have at the institution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Efra. I think Honourable Members have asked some very important questions here. I like the question asked by the Honourable Member that how do you use a person who has brought or persons who have brought some questionable leadership in the company to be again consultants? I think this committee is empowered by constitution to get all the information it requires from Eskom or from DME or from NERSA, and I think as the question that the Honourable Member asked, we'll have to go deeper and direct exact and request for more detailed information of what he has said. I think it may be useful. But without wasting time, I've got some few things that I just want to relate to. These are international opinions about you know, the process that is going on in Eskom, which confuses us as a committee. Well, Eskom, there is an Eskom Act, I think, which gives Eskom the status of converting into a corporate entity, and what that is why the question that has often come from this committee is, is Eskom a public utility or is Eskom a private utility? And it seems that it is a mixture of the two, and therefore it makes it very difficult for this committee to understand some of the things that it wants to understand, because if it is a public utility, then electricity is supposed to be what we call a public good and not a commodity.
And if it is defined as a public good, then it means therefore it complies with the resolutions as have been passed recently in Polokwane about the way forward in our economic policies of the African National Congress. I just want to read some passages here which I think will draw your attention. They say, when through privatization the generation of electricity ceases to be a monopoly, new competitor companies can establish themselves, and for shareholders this changed business context transforms electricity generation from one of the safest investments available to one of the most risky. And that is the direction that we have taken. Continues. Monopolies operate differently from competitive business. In a monopoly, the risk of building new power plants falls on the consumer. If plant construction costs overrun, if the plant is inefficient, or if power stations are built that are not needed, the costs are passed on. A monopoly electricity utility needs sufficient power stations to meet demand. Otherwise, power cuts occur at great national cost and the utility's credibility suffers. To minimize this risk, monopolies tend to over-invest in brand. In the 1980s, for instance, Eskom so overestimated electricity demand that new coal-fired plant had to be mothballed as soon as it had been built. And the cost of this wasted investment fell unwittingly on consumers and taxpayers. Continues. When publicly owned utilities are privatized, stranded assets are seldom identified, and electricity consumers and taxpayers unknowingly bear the costs. In Britain, for example, the publicly owned nuclear company Nuclear Electric completed the size of BPWR in 1995 at a cost in excess of £3 billion. The company whose assets include the Sizewell B and seven other relatively new nuclear plants was sold to private investors a year later for about $1.7 billion, little more than half the cost of building just one of the eight plants sold. Consumers who paid for and owned these plants saw assets with a replacement value of more than £15 billion sold for barely more than a tenth of that sum. That's terrible. That's poor planning. And if people who are presiding over these processes still can be made consultants without being made accountable, instead to perpetuate this, it's terrible. Very, very terrible. These are some of the things that we are going to make a submission to the leadership when we fight NERSA to reconsider its positions. There are many more. Got many more here. Submission. I can go more about with Gwaza here, and we are going to deal with them. All what you have said are not convincing. I'm going to go further. The 60 billion, there was a big argument since this weekend, and especially since yesterday, that NERSA is saying that for the first time it was not given proper information that actually the 60 billion is equity and not a loan. And ANC has submitted, and I think with the union movement, that this 60 billion given to Eskom was equity. It's money which is supposed to support Eskom as a public utility. Now, and NERSA has been arguing, but they are here, they'll tell us what exactly it is, because this is what was in the main news. There was an undertaking here 2 years ago by
by the CEO, former CEO of Eskom, and they were supported by the Minister of Public Enterprise when they came to provide to present on a joint sitting of Science and Technology, Public Enterprise, and Energy. And they said that once the new electrical generator from France had come back to Quebec, they had also negotiated with municipalities and industry for sufficient capacity margins, and so power failures would be a thing of the past. And they have said they quoted 97 billion that time. That over and above, they had 97 billion budgeted to upgrade capacity, a built capacity program. It's interesting now, 2 years later, when the new CEO puts a very grim picture about the situation. And that makes us very suspicious, as the honorable member said, that the same CEO has not gone, it's not left Eskom, it has become a consultant as far as we understand, and is still there. And then he has given a new face to the new CEO. And the CEO now is having the wrath of the people, but he is not probably the person who is supposed to be confronted with this question. But, of course, he accepted the punches, so he will be punched, you see. He will be punched. You are not going to give up until he will bring back the person who must receive punches, you see. But there is another statement, I think, in one of the strike plans of 2006-07, Eskom are guaranteeing that the capacity built will be absorbed by Eskom and not the public. And I think I'm going to quote that. I don't have it. I asked the committee secretary to bring that here, because that was brought to us from Scoba. They showed us, but this is what they said, these people, and this is now what they are saying. And so, how do we then trust this? Because a statement like this coming to Parliament, and a statement that we released in 2005 to the public, that Eskom's power needs have been worked out, everything is in place now. How are we going to face the public? I was invited this past weekend to the Central Committee of NUM, and I understood there, and the minister was also there. So I'm trying to say it wasn't for probably trade unionists or communists. It was everybody invited because of being a main stakeholder in one way or the other. And you know, mines are undergoing a very serious challenge in terms of load shedding and electricity downgrading and capacity. And part of what they said there about this 53%, I want the committee to know this. They said that the negotiations that have gone through NADLAC, and when after those negotiations, after the energy summit, in which the CEO was also present, when a task team was established to then refine and finalize some kind of agreements that were reached, their compromise agreements, they have said that something totally, totally different has come out of this negotiation. And in fact, they said they can say that the negotiation process is at a stop, because they say, look at what they say. They say out of the 53%, that was once asked by Eskom, and which was understood to be an amount that is going to be you know, phased in over a period of 5 years in a smoothed way. Now they are saying that in the negotiations, it came out that the ESCOM and public enterprise, they want, therefore, that immediately there must be 32% rise in electricity prices in tariffs. They say, now when they asked whether this 32% takes into account the recent 14% that was authorized by NRSA, which was the recent application from ESCOM, they say no, the 14% is excluded from the 32%. Then they say calculate. Therefore, 14 plus 32 makes what? 43%. Then they say, then they continue. They say, but over and above, there is also going to be, I think, a 2 cent per kilowatt increase. I don't know about for what, I can't remember. And they say when they calculated the 2 cent, it was 10%. Which then goes to from 43 to 53 already. That is, this is immediate, as we're talking about the smooth way over 5 years. Then they say, after this, now it's already 52%. Then they say, then it will be 20% for the then next 5 years, every year 20%. Then they say, it's going far beyond 100%. Then they said, so they said, no. Then we have not, is anyway, you've just come with a very cunning way. In fact, they call it, I'll tell you, they call it ostrich approach. They say it's an ostrich approach. Ostrich approach is pretentious posture, as if things are solved, when actually the old elements remain as they intact. It's an ostrich approach. And they call the, what has happened, the quantum leap. They say the quantum leap is what is not so easy, just jump. And then you use ostrich approach to then pull down the heads. And they say this is what is happening. And so I think, then they talk about coal. The coal problem, they think we are not supposed to have coal, indeed. We are all agreed. We are the exporter of coal in South Africa. I think if we're not the fourth or the fifth exporter of coal, I would be mistaken, but I think we're at that rank. So they are saying that why are we then having problems of coal in the way we have? Why? They are even going further. Why does the state now for just take 1 or 2 months or three and then make them stay? State companies so that they ask them to get enough coal. If then, or this, if privatization, if maybe coal industry has been privatized, therefore there are problems, it is now regulated. So the state must then take some of the money so that our utility can have consistent supply of energy. So these are some of the things that the committee has to think through, because we can't have a situation where we remain folding arms, powerless, when we have coal, but coal is being exported and our utility doesn't have coal. Unless ESCOM tells us that no, we do have coal, it's just that we have not found a way how to manage it. So, yeah. And lastly, it's yeah, the question of bonuses, as one member also said. Well, information keeps on leaking that already the bonuses of executive are being worked out for the end of June in Moscow, in the midst of this challenge. So we don't know how far through that is, but the CEO will tell us if this is true. Thank you very much. You'd like to respond, your response.
Mr. Chair, in the number of questions, I'm going to, in the first round of answering, maybe just answer a group of questions, because there are some related questions. I think the first point, Mr. Chairman, is maybe a common understanding of why we are where we are. And without defending Eskom, because the problems are happening at Eskom, it may be very easy to say that's where the problem is. But I think both discussions and statements made at the top level leadership in South Africa has indicated that the current challenges stem not only out of the operation issues of Eskom. It stems from policy issues, regulatory issues, issues to do with how the economy has developed. So there's a multiplicity of issues and background which culminates in the situation we are in. And I'm not going to go into the policy issues, but I think they've been well articulated. The issues of regulatory nature, let me just give you an example without also and answering one of the questions. If you knew that you're going to run out of capacity, why didn't you build as Eskom? If the question is directed to Eskom. But before 2004, there was a policy, clear policy, that Eskom, you can't build. And if you then went to the regulator at Eskom before 2004 and says, can you increase the tariff so that I can build? The regulator says, what do you need the tariff increase if you are not allowed to build? Because the policy says, you are not going to build. It's only in 2004, after a policy decision had been made, to say, you must build. Then, 2004 October is a merely 4 years ago. And in the planning, construction, procurement of power station, 4 years is nothing. In that 4 years, we started the process of understanding the task in front of us, scoping what we require in terms of funding, scoping what we require in terms of skills. And the articulation of where we are, as I've indicated, in terms of how much we have spent and how much we need to invest is clear. But, Mr. Chairman, the issue is, unless you understand both policy and regulatory environment that brought us here, you may misdiagnose the problem as an operational issue at Eskom. There are operational challenges at Eskom, which we are dealing with. I take accountability for them. But we need to understand where we are, because there are other factors that played in this space. On the issue of smoothing, and again, Mr. Chairman, I think as I respect the committee's, more policy, more direction, instead of talking numbers, I think we need to talk principles. The issue of smoothing, let me just also indicate that the issue about pricing is not about just 53%, and as if 53% is a silver bullet. The issue of pricing and funding is about how do we fund, one, the big capex that we're undertaking, two, the operations of Eskom. It's not in 1 year, but it's. This company is 85 years old. The assets we are putting, power station, you plan it as if it's going to operate for at least 50 years and beyond. Long-term assets. So when we talk about funding, we are asking for a long-term, predictable, sustainable path. So it's not about whether we get 53% today, and it's can we articulate in the clearest terms how this major undertaking for South Africa is going to be funded in a way that deals with customers, but also deal with the fact that money must be spent to buy the power stations. So as we talk about whether we need to deal with ratings and so forth. And I'm not going to go also into the details, but it's more principles. rating agencies look at what is your financial obligation, what are the things that you're going to be spending on, and what is your revenue stream. If they begin to see a mismatch between your liabilities and your funding stream, they raise alarms that you are not a good investment destination. That's all they look at. So they are making an opinion that says what we see in terms of what you committed to do and what we see in terms of the tariff path, there's a mismatch. So we cannot maintain your credit rating. So that's really the issue. It's not about the 53%, but that's the opinion that they give based on the assessment of liability versus the revenue that you require. The issue of employment, I think, is a very important one. And I think it comes to also what Member Kekana have indicated. We need to grow the economy. The economy to grow requires more energy. And how are we going to solve the problem? In our recommendation about power conservation is to deal with the current operations but also allow for growth. So when we say we need to save, we also want to deal with the current sector of supply but allow for growth. But let me indicate, Mr. Chairman, the issues that give us the confidence that there's room for savings. We are the cheapest priced electricity in the world. We are 74% compared to Canada. Clearly, our energy efficiency, it cannot be the best in the world. Just purely based on price. And studies after studies have indicated that we're probably one of the most inefficient countries per unit of GDP output. So the issue is not only about GDP output, is how can we minimize our energy usage while we maintain or grow our GDP? And that's the national challenge. And when you look at countries where the price of electricity is priced correctly and the culture of energy efficiency is entrenched, you will see that per unit of output of economic units, they are using less energy. So it's possible, but it requires collective action. On the issue of metros, yes, 6 metros, but it's 11 municipalities including the metros. So we do not have 11 metros. I just want to clarify that. The issue of tenders, I may not have clarified. The tenders I was referring to is tenders for large equipment, boilers and turbines. And in the world, there are known global players. In South Africa, we don't have a company in South Africa that plays in that space. However, for instance, in the building of boilers, there's a lot of steel work and welding that is going to happen in South Africa. But the company that is going to be undertaking that tender is an international company. And in fact, it answers the issue about our ASCISA contribution. Part of our ASCISA contribution is trying to begin to hardwire ASCISA requirements and benefits in our procurement spend. When we, these boilers and turbines that we're talking about, in the tender, we wrote down that part of the evaluation is going to be how do you localize your manufacturing, how do you partner with local business people, and how do you develop skills? It's hardwired in there. So that we can, as we issue the tender, be assured that this big spend that ESCOM is undertaking will also result in meeting some of our strategic objectives, which is the ASCISA objective. So it's hardwired in there, and we can give you more details in terms of how many billions will be earmarked for ASCISA, either in small enterprise development or skills development or local capacity expansion for some of the components that will be required for our power stations. The details can be given. The issue of export is a key one. Let me also just give you the quantum extent and how we deal with this issue. Exports accounts maximum 4% of our consumption per annum. It's small, but it's significant, both when you have a problem, but it's also in terms of the principles of saying, if we have a challenge, we cannot just continue to support exports. However, this is the principle that we've used. We have SADC. Underneath SADC, there is an organization called the Southern African Power Pool. It's the SADC member countries' utilities. All the ESCOMs of the region come, subscribe to that entity. And we have spent time trying to say, how do we work together when each one of the countries has got a problem? There's a SAP protocol around emergency. So that when South Africa is short, we actually import. If Botswana is short, we export to them. So it's not only when there is an emergency in South Africa. There have been times when we've been able to import. There's been times when we've been export, but in support of each other. In the current emergency, we've used that protocol. And part of that is to say, if we are load shedding in South Africa 10%, that pain must be shared in the region. But it will be short-sighted that when we have this problem, we just cut ourselves from the rest of SADC and say, we're going to do something different compared to what the protocols say. What I can say without any contradiction is that when we have a problem in South Africa, proportionately, the load shedding also happens in various forms in the rest of SADC. But also, let me also say, as much as we export, we also import. Karabasa is a very significant part of our supply system. If Karabasa was to go away, which can be up to 1,500 megawatts, which is half a power station, we will also have major problems. But also in future, in fact, as we speak, there are a number of projects we are negotiating for power stations to be developed in our neighboring countries. A lot of that power earmarked for South Africa. So it is not in the long-term interest of South Africa to just, when we've got a problem, to cut off. And I think that's probably what the minister was referring to. But I'm sure he'll speak for himself and answer the questions that need to be answered. But I can tell you that the same pain that we get in South Africa is shared, and there's a protocol of how we assist each other in times like this. Mr. Chairman, I think the issue about the price hike on the impact on the economy, I think economists have indicated how it may impact. I don't want to comment, but yes, of course, it will have an impact. But, Mr. Chairman, you must look at both sides. If only look at the tariff side, you may say it will have an impact on the economy and probably negative impact. But just consider, if the long-term viability, sustainability of ESCOM is not assured, what is that implication to the economy of this country? It's both sides. That's the one question. The other question, or the other consideration, I'm sure the fact that we're going to be spending $1.3 trillion in capital formation in South Africa is going to have an impact on the economy of this country. When you look at what is happening at Emelo, just by doing the refurbishment of the Mokolo power station, the positive economic impact there is huge. So you need to look at the broader issue rather than just one part of the issue. I think I take the point about not mentioning China and India. I was mentioning in the context of China and India having an impact on the global supply of capital equipment, because they are the biggest consumer of those. So as they grow, we are seeing the prices are going up because people responding to it, and also the fact that suppliers are prioritizing China and India because of the volumes we get impacted. That's really the issue that I wanted to make. There was a question about the specific about what will our balance sheet look like, our income statement, if we have the 53%. I can give you the numbers, you know, I can send the numbers to the secretary. I don't have them on top of at the top of my head, and I don't want to make mistakes, and these things are on the record, so I would rather give you an accurate breakdown of how the income statement, the balance sheet, will look like if we get the 53%. And those numbers are in the public domain and are also included in the NASA application. So the issue of planning, Mr. Chairman, poor planning, as I've indicated, the biggest contributor is not only about planning, it's the policy, regulatory, and, of course, operational issues in ESCOM that conspire to put us where we are. And we will not get out of where we are if we just look at ESCOM to get out. We're going to look at, get out of where we are if we deal with policy, we deal with regulation, and we deal with a total usage across the system. It's not an ESCOM issue. And I think as much as the issues that I have to deal with at ESCOM, I take accountability for them. Even if ESCOM works 100%, we won't get out of this. So the issue is broader than ESCOM. And I think, Mr. Chairman, this committee is going to be key in ensuring that intervention in policy is the right intervention, not to repeat the same issues that we've dealt with. I think, Mr. Chairman, I hope I've dealt with the issue of the pricing regime, and maybe NASA could deal with that. Is ESCOM a private company or a public company? ESCOM is a company operated along accepted corporate governance as any company, but with one shareholder, which is the state, but clear direction, policies, strategic direction we get from the shareholder. But the issue is, Mr. Chairman, whether we are a public company or a private company, a power station costs $80 billion. It must be funded. Money must flow to fund it. How that money is got, where we get from the government, that $84 billion must flow from ESCOM to that particular company. And funding agencies will look at that liability versus your revenue stream and say, can we borrow ESCOM money or not? So that model is undisturbed, irrespective. Now, what you could talk about is whether a private company may have a higher expectation of returns than a state-owned company. And that's what the shareholder is looking at, to make sure that ESCOM's mandate reflects that its primary objective is that of public good rather than of profit maximization. And the shareholder is looking at that. They look at that. But it's more about long-term viability to deal with the funding that is required.
I'm glad you've said that. That's a very important statement.
The issue of skills, Mr. Chairman.
I'm coming to the issue of skills. Maybe let me deal with it. As you indicated, the skills is not an ESCOM problem only. Particularly technical, artisan, engineering, project management is the skills across society in South Africa, and also an international phenomenon. I mean, I'll just give you an anecdotal evidence. Where we are doing refurbishment in Ermelo area, it is not unusual to get in the Ermelo Times, the local newspaper, an advert put there by an Australian company looking for project engineers. And that's they're looking at South Africa, and they know where the people will be, and they are doing the recruiting. So it's a global phenomenon. So, in fact, some of the things that we did with at risk. Even before 2004, when we scanned and looked at whether indeed private players will come into South Africa to build, we were very skeptical. And some of the things that we did was to say, let's begin to prepare But at some point, somebody's going to say, look, no one is coming, Eskom built. That's why the speed at which we were able to respond since 2004 is what it is. Otherwise, if we have let people go and we didn't do what we did, we would have been caught netting. So we did look at the skills that we had in Eskom, but what we increasingly are doing, particularly on the projects, is partnering with international companies, well-known names like Black & Veatch, BP Power, where we say we don't have project skills, but you guys have a global base. We're going to partner with you in project managing this big station. And we're going to bring our guys and partner with you guys for skills transfer. That's one area that we're doing. The other is we're going overseas as well to recruit similar skills that we require. In some cases we've been successful, but the biggest issue is the issue of funding. I mean, if you know the dollar and the pound, competing with dollar and pound salaries is a big issue. So we prioritize former South Africans. They've got a bigger incentive for coming back rather than just money. So those are the kind of things that we're doing. But also, we are beginning to spend a lot of money on training on our side. Artisan training, expanding those facilities. But it's a combination of things. But it is still a big challenge going forward.
In the interest of time, I think if you can try and summarize those responses, because it seems that there are members who have to rush to another meeting at 12:30.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe I'll stop there. I mean, if there's any other follow-ups, I can deal with. But I think I'll stop. Maybe just one issue. I think the issue of bonuses, Mr. Chairman. We have not received bonuses. The calculation of bonuses has not happened. But clearly the authority that has to deal with bonuses is our board. And I have every confidence that they will not only look at the technical calculation. They will also say, what is it that we must do about bonuses in the current context? And I think they will make that judgment. My own view is that we have to have a different remuneration structure that acknowledges the kind of challenges that we have, but begin to incentivize people to deal with the issues that we need to deal with going forward. So that's my own view, and my own view is that it will not be proper to be seen to profit out of a very deep emergency in South Africa. And I think the leadership in Eskom is alive to that. But at the same time, Mr. Chairman, this is what we need to consider. The power system challenges is probably the biggest challenge in South Africa. You need to attract, retain the best and the brightest. They must feel valued, respected, and trusted to execute this mandate. And incentives, whether we like it or not, is part of that. And for me, in looking at how we come out of this, I'm going to be looking at incentives as part of a scheme of recovery to come out of that. But it doesn't mean we're going to get people to profit out of the emergency. But what it means, we need to attract, retain, motivate our most brightest and our most capable. And they must feel valued. They must feel respected, they must feel trusted to execute what is in front of us to deal with this big challenge. Thank you.
So in short, the bonuses will be now called incentives, and they are being worked out. So, but what will come out in June 1, the bonus will be incentive for emergency the great work. Okay. But you haven't addressed my question, the very controversial thing that is in the media about 60 billion equity or loan. But also, it doesn't go, and also going hand in hand with that, also in the media, they are saying that there are investigations going on whereby these bonuses that we're talking about were actually inflated, using funds which are supposed to be maintenance for asset
any suggestion that we cooked the books to get big bonuses. We reject that with contempt. They are checks and balances, both internally to ESCOM. We've got auditors, we've got a shareholder looking over these things, and we, just for our credibility, we won't do that. And I think the fact that there is an application in front of the regulator indicating over expenditure on coal beyond what was allowed, if we go this year with that over expenditure, over the past 3 years, we would have spent $13 billion over and above what was budgeted. So we didn't stop buying coal or stop using power stations on the basis of financial consideration. So I think we need to give that clear message that we reject that suggestion. There is no evidence to suggest that. And the books of ESCOM are open for anybody to scrutinize.
Which means the bonuses were well secured in the past years. The bonuses were well secured. $60 billion.
The $60 billion is seven. I think we are working with the shareholder to work out on the modalities of that disbursement. At the moment, it's still not finalized, but it's commitment from the Treasury, which we need to work out how it's going to be dispersed over how many years. Whether it's equity or shareholder, that's still being dealt with.
Because of a single shareholder, what has happened? Because we haven't been working at a loss. What has happened over the years? I mean, say 4 years ago, when you started to tell them, when they said, now you can expand. What has happened to the profits that they're making, giving them back to the shareholder? Why is the shareholder referring you to the public person now?
Mr. Chairman, what are the drivers that are pushing our cost up in this current period? Two areas. The first one, an increased capital expenditure, which we didn't have in the past years. So that's the one big element. The second element, as we've indicated, is the cost of primary energy. And that also stems from a constrained reserve margin. Those are the two aspects. In the past, yes, we paid dividends, but we have an agreement now with the shareholder that we don't pay dividends because we are in this big capital expenditure. But when you look at our books going forward, the sizes of profits are even such that we won't be able to even pay dividends if we wanted to. So that has been dealt with, so we won't be paying dividends going forward. But the underlying issue, Mr. Chairman, is that even if we are not paying dividends, the size of the spend is so big that you cannot just deal with that just from cash from operations. If tariffs don't change, or there's a big commitment by the shareholder.
Yeah, probably. That's why you don't say that you have chosen a quantum leap. You are supposed to move steadily, not just leap like that. And if you are saying you are paying for over 50 years, move steadily in a whatever right angle triangle way to the 50-year target, and don't simply leap from here to there, because then you are faced with all these problems of immediate funding, which now makes you be very, very unpopular with the public. I think we'll have, but we'll consider all those things. We think we have to make our own submission as a committee about all these things, which I think we will read through our reasoning why we think things should be done. Because at the end, we are, as you said, policy regulators. We have to regulate policy where there are policy gaps or where there are policy shortcomings. I think we have to come in. And I think time has come for this committee to be actively participating in policy direction so as to help you as the state entity to really have a smooth way forward. Thank you very much.
which I think going to hear from, I think you have answered a lot of what the NASA has to answer now, except that they must tell us whether they are going to give you what you want or not.
That's the important question.
Yes. Yeah. So, but they won't tell you in your presence. I'm sure they asked us last time. I don't know if this time they are not worried, they don't mind. But the NASA, I'll give you some few minutes to. Yeah, I don't think your minutes will be very, very greatly reduced.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our members are saying that we should have, next time we should have ESCOM alone and have enough day, the whole day. And enough to whole day with NERSA. It means we have to organize a workshop for 2 days.
Mr. Chairman, I was
and it will be sponsored by ESCOM.
I was about to say nature has its way, and it has determined that it has to be that way, incidentally. Because in any event, Mr. Chairman, this has made our life very easier. Because we do have sitting in front of us as a regulator considering ESCOM's application. And we were going to make a disclaimer that we are not going to address any issue relating to that application, and we may not answer any question that arises and relates to that particular application. However, Mr. Chairman, we do realize there are one or two things that we want to correct in the pact that we have been given, and I'm happy that Mr. Bukula here, who is the regulator member primarily responsible for electricity and who is the chairperson of the electricity subcommittee and the panel that is currently listening to the public opinions, is going to just reflect that particular slide, and then that would be all. We'll take questions, if any.
Why is your hand up and your micro on?
I
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Otherwise, the public will have will doubt my chairman.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. The presentations in your the slides that you have, I think the slide that we just need to explain is the slide number 6, and in particular in that one, when we advertised initially, we were going to have a public hearing only on the date of the 23rd of May, but we received more than 370 submissions from the public and the different organizations, and as a result we had to extend the dates for our public hearing to the 23rd, the 27th and the 29th, so the next or the last public hearing is going to be tomorrow. And that has also necessitated that because of the amount of submissions that we've received, we need to then shift the dates. The initial date where we're going to make a decision was the 6th of June, but because of the increased number of public hearings, we've then moved the date of the final decision to the 18th of June. So that's the first part I wanted to make clear.
We also want to make submissions now, but we wanted to make submissions after we've met with you.
Okay.
That's why we said we wanted you to come here, because we have to discuss, and then after that we make submissions also ourselves if we don't agree.
Oh, okay. I think Mr. Mgwena will be able to answer that from the process side. The one other slide I just wanted to show was that in the stakeholders that we have met or that have presented, I don't want to mention names, but I think the first presenter was the Freedom Front Plus, and the last presenter yesterday was the ANC, and in between there was NEDLAC and the others. There are 5 points that are really emerging. One is there seems to be some agreement between the different parties and organizations that whatever price increases that should be seen by South Africans, they should be smooth over a period of 5 years with an agreement of what the target price is for those 5 years. Other organizations, in fact, the lowest proposal for a price increase for 2008-09 up until 2011-12 is a 14.5% increase real per annum. Others have said 19.5, but I think that's the minimum. The other thing that came very clear is that in whatever tariff structures that are being proposed, we've got to have tariff structures that are pro-poor, that are sensitive to the South African situation. Some have suggested that we should start by having a 100 kilowatt hours per month, they're free, and thereafter move to a tariff that is also just saying looking at the cost, and thereafter move to different levels of tariffs, but all of that to ensure that whatever increases are going to come from the application or from the South African situation, they do not adversely affect the poor or those who can least afford. The third point that really came out clearly is that for the ESCOM application, the demand-side management funds should not be included in the tariff application that ESCOM has put forward. Instead, the government should fund the DSM. People put different reasons. Others say that ESCOM cannot be saying that, I mean, you're selling a product, you can't say on the other side, I'm going to also promote not selling of the product. Electricity is a product that needs to be sold. Demand-side management says use less, so you can't have the same organization spreading the same message. That's the other view. The other view is that, for us to be in this situation, it was because of some of the errors that were made by government, so they should fund that. But which one is right is probably a matter that we will get to decide. The other factor that came, or which was very clear, is that whichever way that we are going to go, there must be increased funding from government. And yes, it was our understanding as the energy regulators that the 60 billion rand was a loan that was given, its terms and conditions are not clear. So whether they are going to be changed into equity or what is what has not been communicated. Yes, at the question that was asked, a member of the ANC did say that it was equity. But the official record that we have is that it is a loan with terms that are not defined. And I think Mr. Marocha probably explained it better than I did. And the last point that came is that,
the allegations that are made about what prices international customers pay, what prices do big users pay, and what should be the pricing structure anyway. And if you look at the South African situation right now, the pricing policy has a little bit of a vacuum around that. So what also came out was that, you know, the conclusion of a pricing policy that then encapsulates all of the views of the South Africans around poor pricing and also not getting big industries that use energy to be priced at levels that that, because in the past how they got to get here, they were told that energy is cheap here, so come here, and 10 years down the line they can't be told that no, please go away, things have changed, because it doesn't just take a day to dismantle that thing. So something around that also has to be concluded. And those were the main ones, but these were shared by most of the presenters, I mean, which range from your normal household to organizations of residents and organizations of pensioners, and I think that sums that up. And as far as the questions around what's going to happen, I'm sure myself and Mr. Mgwena will answer what we may, and we will indicate what we may not.
Yeah, but also remember that also consumers were told that since 1994 they promised that they'll have electricity, all inaccessible to electricity will be accessible and at a reasonable price level. And that was also told. So it was told to the industry, it was also told to the consumer. So who are you going to protect? That's it.
If I may respond to that, I think the pricing policy that's going to be there is aware of the issues. For instance, if you just talk about the poor and the indigent and you look at the percentage of them, it's less than 2% of your consumers. And in a way, I'm sure there's a way in which it can be done. But I also don't want to start getting into an avenue that that hasn't been debated. But I think that the figures are known and solutions from what is at hand can be put on the table.
Okay, I'll allow some concise interaction with the members, if at all. But yeah, it looks like there is progress in the negotiation. That is progress than what we were talking about.
Now, the just one concern that I've got, Chair, is that I know that everything is working within policy and legislation. But I'm looking at the conclusion of this matter. Probably as NERSA, if you come up with your determination and we're all not happy, what could be the next? I think you are the goalkeepers, you are the final people, but I'm just checking as to what would be your expectation, because I can see a lot of things happening. We just had this xenophobic attack that have been taking place. I don't know what is next once you determine.
Any further input? If not, let's allow the response to that one. Right.
Chairperson, I don't think we can predict as to what will happen. But what we can safely show, what we can safely say, and that we are sure of, is that our task is to ensure that a licensee that operates efficiently and produces electricity efficiently at a reasonable price must earn a reasonable return. And when we are faced with an application, we must then consider it. And that's exactly what we are doing. We are following a due process. And such a due process will have to take into consideration all the submissions, first of all the application itself, interrogate the figures, look at all the submissions that have been made, as my colleague has indicated, more than 370, and we're having more than 39 presentations. It's unprecedented in the history of this country. In fact, as you know, we are holding this public hearing at an auditorium at UDISA because our own place can't accommodate such numbers. So I am sure that a regulator consisting of 9 members
following legislation, considering all facts, evidence, and information presented to them, they would definitely arrive at a conclusion that is appropriate for this particular circumstance. And therefore, without putting my neck on the block, I am definitely sure that the decision will not cause any disharmony within the society. With regard to the point that you made, Chairperson, I'm sure you may have said it in a light manner, because as an august body that established the legislation, as a matter of fact, one of our very first principles as a regulator is the rule of law, and we follow that law in to the letter. So we are having our final 3-day public hearings tomorrow, and as Mr. Bukula indicated, next week the subcommittee sits and recommends to the energy regulator on the 18th. So I think we are well on course, and we have responded to your invitation here. As an oversight body, we had to come and talk to you. Otherwise, I'm sure that if it was any other body, we wouldn't have done that, because we would have been dealing with something that is really other people would refer to as sub judice. But in this particular case, I'm sure you would not want to interfere with the role that you have as an oversight body. Thank you very much.
I just add that in the part where people are not accepting the decision made by the regulator, there's legal recourse, and I think the first would be ESCOM, where the legal recourse, but it goes via the High Court. So it's not as though when we've said it, that's it. There is another way in which our decision can be challenged, but I think that ESCOM would be the first one too, but it doesn't prevent others, as we have to make decisions having looked at the affected parties.
Yeah, there is that part in terms of your stakeholders making presentations. Do you have government making presentation as government? Because with those summarized points, especially those which have a direct reference to government, they have direct reference to the fiscus. You know, obviously, when you say that there should be necessary to have increased government funding, the government has to look into its fiscus to make determinations or to make sure that they meet the demands of the regulator. So I'm just saying that that is an observation I have, that more often than enough, the government departments take decisions, cabinet takes decisions, decisions which impacts on the fiscus, only to find that on implementation, the Minister of Finance comes and says it's not possible to implement that recommendation by the either regulator or by ESCOM, because as soon as there is a regulation or determination on how and when the prices have to increase and how the government has to participate in the funding, you see, because we do have a situation where we have to raise money. ESCOM needs about 327 billion of francs to actually intervene decisively on the backlog. Obviously, there's a need to have government participating. It will have a bearing on the fiscus. So I just want to check from NERSA's side if, from their consultation and public hearings, they had a view, because if you take it for granted, you may find that you make a determination which is impossible on the part of government.
Let me answer by saying that the department, in fact, the National Treasury, which is the department you're referring to, was scheduled to present yesterday, and they just postponed to present the following day, and they have given us a submission pointing out whatever points that needs to be pointed out. I mean, there's a point, there's a 2 cents per kilowatt hour levy that was mentioned in the budget speech, and that still has not been concluded. But having said that, the submission by NEDLAC and one of the ministers within NEDLAC is the one who has National Treasury and Finance also indicates some of these issues. And in our view, these are issues that are within the site of the department that will decide on this. I mean, certain suggestions that have been made in the public hearing were to say that even the 60 billion rand loan or equity or whatever it is, in the way that it was initially determined, maybe it would help if you change the backloading that it was that was on it, and you front load it. That is, you bring more money in the first years and reduce it as you go forward. But those are suggestions that are going to go back to them, and part of the determination would have considered their written responses to those suggestions.
Yeah, the last important thing is just because we are the oversight structure to you. It would be a very terrible a tragedy after coming from here that then a situation arises which one member here has asked and one wasn't adequately or probably optimally answered to. That we have a situation where you take a decision which spills people of South Africa onto the streets, you see, and I think you'll weigh all these, because if your public hearings are almost about to end, it means we no longer have a chance as an oversight organ to bring in very convincing arguments about what today. So all of us remains within an appeal platform, which is this one, that be careful that the decision you take does not spill the people of South Africa into the streets, and therefore where it adds on what has already happened. Because I have heard the resolution already taken in some other quarters that should you take a decision that is at the direct contrast with the majority of the people of South Africa, it means you will not be taking the people of South Africa into consideration, and so you'll spill them in the street. So I think that's just a warning about take a very careful look at the end of this process, that you look how many people have come out to complain or to put their views, and what type of solution you can arrive at, which is going to leave the situation still amicable for the majority of the people of South Africa. I think that is very important, because the resolutions have been taken in other sectors that should, anything should the animals not be heated, then we are going into the streets, you see. And so it will be terrible if it represents the majority, you see, who mandated us and you to be where we are, you see. Okay, thank you very much. I think we can excuse you. We are left with a very short time, but I don't know, it's upon us as a committee to decide what to do. We still have the MPRDA presentation. We could probably listen only to the responses of what they what they arrived at from the concerns that were raised, and then we can postpone the whole thing for next week, because we're still meeting next week, and then we can deal thoroughly with the rest of that situation. I don't know, but what are the members' viewpoints?
No, Chairperson, I just want to indicate that NERSA had two presentations, but they've just presented one. But I can see that the time is against us. There's this document about inquiry into the national electricity supply shortage, which I know that they were prepared to present it, and we were going to ask questions, but I don't think there's much that can
be. But they did say that they would rather those two presentations rather come separately to address us. They have said so. This is both of them. Yeah, that's what they said. So we will find time to incorporate them to come and address us full time as their entity alone. Yeah. Honorable
I was trying to check on the wisdom of dealing with the presentation from the legal people on MPRCA. Can we maybe deal with it on next week? Is it possible that we deal with it when they come again with everybody? And we may ask, we can apologize as a committee from the stakeholders, and I know that the Chamber of Mines is here and other stakeholders. Maybe they can also express a view, but do we feel on our side that we're not going to do justice to the presentation today?
Yeah, here's an appeal, honorable members. We have a lot of stakeholders that have come all the way. That's my problem here. And they have seen that it's been business. We haven't had any gaps up until now. Even the people that are leaving us now, we haven't even been able to finish. I think we need more time than we usually allocate ourselves. These issues are very, very far-reaching. We need more time. Even themselves, the MPRCA, I think we need almost something like the one day or half a day to discuss these issues. We can't discuss issues like this over 40 minutes or 1 hour. I think therefore we must agree that we must find time next week when we must dedicate ourselves to this whole empathy. And that will invite all those who have got concerns. I think we must do as we said. We must circulate those responses together with the final draft. We must circulate the responses today together with the final draft to all those who were involved in the initial publication so that they know the final version what it is, and so that they can then have input and feed us back before next week, and then we will then invite them to come next week and we deal with those concerns. We will try and, if possible, organize that it's probably we can organize a special time, it's a special, extended time, so that we can deal with the issues. But I think we have been given time that we can attend to this problem and not rush it, because it's not in the interest of many people of South Africa and even Parliament, not to allow, not to give stakeholders and people of South Africa to ventilate their concerns. So I think we are going to allow that. So it's not ever going to be as urgent as they gave us the deadline for next week. So we can therefore deal with it with sufficient focus next week and in days beyond next week. And I think we'll still be on course. So I think what we can do today is that you give us those responses as you have, and we circulate them together with that final draft to all those who did not, or all those stakeholders that were participants of the initial hearings. And then we can therefore next week meet and on a more extended time which we are going to apply for, and then listen to all the concerns of the stakeholders. Probably we can start with looking into the concerns that the public, the department has come and just addressed the concerns, all of them as they are. Then if they are satisfied, then we can take the matter forward. I think that's how we must deal with it. Is that agreed? What was I say? I see that themselves have been with me nodding. Well, their nodding is not recorded, but they should put it on record that they agree with my proposal. I give it to you, DNA.
Thank you, Chairperson, and the honourable members. I just need some clarity first, Chairperson, around what you're saying, that the stakeholders will be given another chance, and then next week they come back and they still give us more of their questions, or are you talking about the ones that already have been sent to the PPC? So I'd like to get some clarity on that so that we can begin to prepare ourselves.
What we said, we have said that, you know, the according to the committee section, the concerns that we circulated to you were only about 4 or 5, and they only came from those who were able to see the final draft as it stands, and so they made comment on the final draft. But according to my understanding from the committee section, is that this final draft was never circulated to all of them who were there originally for public hearing, so they do not know what the final draft looks like. Those that have been able to see it, they have only picked it up on the streets, you see, and then they made comments, and the comments that we gave to you. So what we are now saying is that it is better, therefore, what we had said, said to the department, that says that it's better that we circulate the draft to all the stakeholders together with whatever the comments they have, if they are. Or probably you can simply withhold even those responses and only give them to the committee, and then we wait when all of them have received, they have seen the draft, and then we treat all of them at once, and respond to them at once if we think this is the matter, the direction we should take, or whether we invite them and we sit with them, we address their concerns, whatever. I do not know what it will be like, but the first process is that they have to see the final draft, all of them, not only 4 or 5 who have requested it. All of those that did not see the final draft, I have said to the committee secretary, must circulate that final draft to all of them. And I said to you that you must respond to those concerns that already were put by those who had seen the final draft, and then we meet next week. Next week I am saying now that we must apply for more time than the committee time, so that we are able to then attend to all those concerns. And if there are still further concerns, then we will take it from there.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think we will have to come back next week then, and hopefully there will be more time so that we can address the concerns that will be raised between now and then. And as far as the ones that have come through, we would be happy to send back to the committee secretariat the responses by tomorrow, and then they will be circulated to the honourable members. Thank you.
I think that is a great for members, right. I think therefore today's session is for adjourned.